Everybody gets a piece, we're going mainstream. Everybody's gonna eat, we're going mainstream. All my family is sick. See you on Main Street, we're going mainstream.
From Wall Street to Melrose Avenue,
we're going mainstream.
Venture capitalists to athletes to
we're
creators
mainstream.
To the person who's collected trading cards.
Welcome back to the Altcoins Mainstream Podcast. Today's episode is with a fintech founder who has scaled one of the larger private markets investing platforms for individual investors. Michael is the founder and CEO of Yield Street, a leading private market investing platform with more than 450,000 members and $4 billion invested as of October 2023. An award-winning entrepreneur, he co-founded Yield Street in 2015 with an ambition of providing individual investors access to curated private markets assets typically reserved for institutions. As CEO, Michael leads Yield Street's strategic vision to make alternatives a fundamental piece of investor portfolios. Before Yield Street, Michael held a variety of positions across the specialty finance spectrum, including founding Soli Capital. Previously, Michael was a vice president at a New York-based credit opportunities hedge fund with $1.2 billion under management. Michael and I had a fascinating conversation about the evolution of private markets and how to deliver investment opportunities directly to consumers. We discussed the business evolution of Yield Street, how they work with both individuals and advisors, and what he thinks is important when it comes to providing investors with access to private markets. Thanks, Michael, for coming on the Altcoins Mainstream Podcast to share your views on private markets.
We're going mainstream.
Michael, welcome to the Altcoins Mainstream Podcast.
Thank you for having me, Michael. I'm excited to do it.
Pleasure to have you on. You've built one of the earlier and larger companies in the alt space. So excited to get into that. But first, would love to hear your background. You were in the investment world before, ended up founding Yield Street. How did that all come about?
My background is really started in the real estate sector, hustling as anyone could. I was making 125 calls a day, two phones. I was trying to find clients who were buying or refinancing a building that I could help place the financing for them. And then during the crisis, when real estate became taboo, I found an opportunity at a private credit fund who was specializing in asset-based lending and in specialty finance products. I loved it. I loved the creativity of it. I felt that there was this view that perceived risk is not necessarily actual risk. And being able to generate alpha in things that were a little bit more esoteric became very exciting and attractive to me. I started out doing things that were a little bit boring, like receivable finance and purchase order funding. Then found myself doing super exciting things like providing loans to professional athletes during the NBA lockout or to football players and litigation finance and other interesting asset classes. During that time, the private credit market started to really boom. There was limited capital coming out of the 2008 financial crisis, and it became a real opportunity to provide private debt in the market. We were getting paid very, very handsome returns. What happened was I was very fortunate to be at the right place at the right time and became successful at a young age when I would get back together with my friends over the weekends or whatnot, and doctors, lawyers, dentists, or my parents or cousins. Nobody was being able to invest in these private markets. It was a billionaire's playground. It was a big bank playground. And I realized that there are so many people that thought they did the right thing. They invested, they put all their money in Schwab or they put all their money in a brokerage. 2008 came, market dipped like crazy. They got really nervous. They did the one thing they shouldn't have done, but they were emotional in that moment. They pulled their money out of those accounts, and you can never really recover from that. On the one hand, I'm seeing myself young and successful, having access to a market that is so limited and such like a billionaire's boys club. And on the other hand, I'm realizing that people don't have a healthy way to invest. And 2008 became a very clear sort of realization that there has to be a better way and that private markets need to complement your traditional public market exposure. I became hyper passionate about trying to make that available to more people. And that's really how Yield Street was born.
Why did you start with the strategies that you started with? Like you say, you grew up in the esoteric investment world of private markets. But you started with some of those strategies with Yield Street as well, rather than starting with more traditional vanilla alt strategies.
I'll give you a little view into my head. One, I'm obsessed with customer experience. I'm probably always in the top 20 customers at Yield Street. I have 40 active investments, maybe more at any given time. I'm the biggest critic. I'm the best cheerleader. Building Yield Street has been something that we did for ourselves, for our friends, for our family, and we tried to lead with that view. So that's part one, how we think about it. And to be very transparent, we are not a collection of the smartest people in the world. We might be a collection of the luckiest people in the world. We were in the right place at the right time. In 2014, the Jobs Act started to roll into play. It sounds funny to say these things, but people started using Facebook aggressively at that time and actually like using the internet. I know it sounds wild to say that now, but it was 10 years ago almost. And so consumer marketing became something that was very attractive. Hey, could you actually acquire and reach tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or millions of people in a way that would have taken me multiple lifetimes of lunches and dinners, which used to be the traditional way to raise capital? And is technology maturing to a place where you could create a seamless, beautiful digital experience? And those three things really started to come together in a meaningful way in 2014 and 15. We saw an opportunity. I had experience in the private markets. I knew that it was a better way for people to invest and that people would want access to it, but didn't have it. And I got lucky that the regulatory, the marketing capability, and technology were at the same time. My co-founder and partner at the time, we had two different backgrounds. I came with a finance background, the investment background. He came with a consumer marketing background. That sort of fusion of financial services and tech, that real fintech, not fake fintech, that real fintech coming together propelled our business forward. You take that as a backdrop. Now, why did we start with the opportunities we did? You got to create what we call moments of joy. We started with the hardest customer and the most esoteric strategy. Everybody else in fintech starts in one of two ways. Can we lend you money, consumer card businesses, Prosper, Lending Clubs, all those businesses, or can we pay you higher deposit rates, sort of hot deposit game? We'll offer you an extra 50 basis points or an extra 100 basis points and people are going to come running. There was no real innovation. There was no real value that you were creating for people. People were so used to getting one deposit in a month or two, their paycheck, and everything else was going out. We want it to be the opposite. How do we create moments of joy? So one, credit assets that provide current income was a way for us to show people it worked. You picked a deal, which is hard to separate from your money. You made an investment, and now all of a sudden, there's monthly deposits coming in. Here's my interest. Here's my interest.
It's a really interesting point, because as I think with a lot of these investment platforms, they often see upticks in user engagement whenever someone opens the statement. It's not a user experience where people are logging in every day, like they might, as an example, with their Robinhood account, trying to check their brokerage account or make trades. That's not what private markets are for. But interestingly, I think you hit on something when you think about where to start, is that private credit, people are getting their money back faster. So how much did you think that part of that would be getting people to engage with private markets on a more regular basis than if you did something more long-dated like private equity or venture to start?
100%. That was it. How do we create moments of joy? That was the whole strategy. People are going to come here. We're not selling you a t-shirt for 10 bucks. We're asking you for $25, $50, $100,000. So we need to build trust with technology, which was very different at that time. Like the idea of dropping $50,000 over five clicks was a crazy thing. So A, we had to get you to do that. And then we wanted you to build a portfolio from 50 to 100 to 500 and beyond. The whole play was proven strategies that have a deep track record that we know work. We have confidence in the performance. And two, that they're going to create moments of joy by bringing you back cash flow. And if you got that cash flow month after month, you would say, oh, I really like this. Let me do more. That was the whole strategy.
You said another really interesting thing a few minutes ago, which was balancing the fin and the tech. With many of these platforms, I think it really is a balance. Do you think one is more important than the other, kind of having more fin than tech or more tech than fin? How do you think about that, the interplay between those two?
No, I don't. I actually think that's a big mistake. I would argue that there hasn't been a tremendous amount of innovation in fintech. I think if you look at some of the biggest incumbents in fintech over the last 10 years, I think this next 10 years will be the golden age of fintech. I think the last 10 years was more of a person with a finance background hiring a good CTO or a technologist to becoming a CEO and hiring someone with a finance background. The problem with those is the organization is either led with sort of brilliant technology, but very little commercialization in business, i.e. you've seen a lot of it in blockchain or in different areas of crypto where people are talking about all the digitization of assets. But the truth is they haven't commercialized it and it doesn't really create any additional value. over longer time, like having distributed ledger and other things are interesting. But like this tokenization of private equity to sell hasn't done anything for anyone. And on the flip side, you could have people with deep finance backgrounds that are saying, oh, we're a fintech company. Really what they do is they have a huge top of funnel marketing budget, and then they have 200 people in a warehouse in some other place doing what they say is all automated underwriting. One of the things we were very passionate about is actually having two founders co-managing a business, leading a business, one driving this sense of deep technology, really creating delightful customer experience, building the most sophisticated distribution infrastructure in the world. And on the other side, having respect for the regulatory infrastructure. How many people have gotten in trouble sort of blowing through SEC or FINRA requirements? So having respect for the regulatory infrastructure, understanding the talent you need to have to provide sound investment strategy, and sort of fusing the two together to really build something special. Looking back almost 10 years now, our closest market participant is 25% of our size. We built a category. We're a clear category leader. We have U.S. and international capabilities. Nobody even comes close. We're the only multi-strat platform out there.
Where I want to go next with this too is you started out on the individual investor side, enabling people to invest $25, $50, $100,000 checks. You've also now partnered with the advisor channel, with a partnership with Luma that's enabled you to now offer structured notes through the advisor channel. How do you think about the evolution of Yield Street platform, starting with individual investor, and why did you start there, now adding in the advisor channel as well?
I would summarize Yield Street as two core pillars. Those are our moats. That's the whole business. Number one, most sophisticated distribution infrastructure in the world. Number two, a beautiful digital experience. Now, what does that mean? Going back, we're obsessed with customer centricity and customer experience. So 9 years ago, we're conceiving of the business. And our view is that if you look at consumer behavior at the time, it was dramatically changing. We used to look for individual experiences to have the best outcome. We went to the baker, the fisherman, the butcher, the flower shop, and the list goes on. Today, nobody does that. You go to Whole Foods. We used to have our BlackBerry, or before that, our Palm Pilot, and our StarTAC or our Nokia. Now we have our iPhone or our Android. We do everything in one place. We used to have a very big separation between work, live, and play. Over the last 5 years, the urbanization of how we live has completely changed. Why weren't we seeing that in financial services? We were still expecting to go to 20 different platforms. I got my real estate over here, my private credit over here, my structured notes over there, my stocks over there. That didn't make sense to us. If you really want to serve a client the right way, we should not be in the business of selling you a deal. We should be in the business of telling you, Michael, we think that a healthy portfolio has 30% alternatives. Come, let's show you how to build a diversified portfolio. And what we should do on a day-to-day basis is try to find the best risk-adjusted opportunities in the market. And that's going to change with the market. So in 2021, everybody was all about growth and equity, private equity, art equity, real estate equity, et cetera. Today, people are more concerned about the market. They want slightly shorter duration. They want cash flow. They want income. They want safer. They want less volatile. No one else could provide that. So our view was from day one, we're going to start with one asset class and we're going to continue to expand until we could give you a holistic offering. To do that, we had to keep building the technology that would enable us to distribute, track, and provide the right experience for you. So there's senior secured debt, there's mezzanine, there's pref equity, there's equities, all these different components of deal structure in the private market. And we had to build the capability to distribute, track, and report upon those. Looking back now, what do we have? The most sophisticated distribution infrastructure ever. We have real estate, in that we have SFR, BFR, we have debt. We have equity, we have structured notes, we have CMBS, we have a 40 Act fund, we have a REIT, we have third-party fund distribution, we have non-accredited, accredited, QP product. We have this huge infrastructure that could distribute alternatives in a way that no one else can. So that's number one. Number two is, how do you provide a seamless user experience? So then you have to ask yourself, well, who is my user and what do you want to be? So Yield Street wants to be a one-stop shop where investing in private market alternatives is seamless. And it doesn't matter who the audience is. The audience is our core, which is our high net worth. There's 45 million Americans, 30 trillion of investable assets. And there's a huge amount moving, another 70 from the boomers to the next generation. Then you have your family offices, endowments, RIAs, smaller institutions who are looking for sort of middle market, high yielding private exposure. And then you have your B2B2C. You have your advisors who are saying, hey, we need to provide our clients with a healthier portfolio. We know they need to have alternative exposure. We need solutions. We need consistent supply. We need OCIO capabilities. We need products for accredited investors. And we need to be able to provide for a healthy platform. So ultimately, what we want to do is be able to leverage our distribution infrastructure, our proprietary origination, to distribute to anyone who wants to buy it. And how we do it is simple. There's three experiences that capture the whole audience. One is do it yourself. You go on the platform, you find an investment, you like it, you're sophisticated for yourself, for your client, and you pick individual investments, you build your portfolio. Two, you say, there's a thematic view I have. I want real estate exposure. I want specialty finance exposure. I want art exposure, but I don't want to pick individual offerings. So we'll guide them to a diversified portfolio or a thematic fund. The third is do it for me. Hey, we want you to allocate this much for our client. This is their risk profile, or we want to give you X dollars and keep an actively managed, diversified alts portfolio. We are able to now provide those three audiences, individuals, family office, endowment institution, or advisors, do it yourself, guide me, or do it for me.
As you think about how you construct platform and what your investors want, what would you say investors tend to spend the most time doing? Is it the DIY self-directed, choose your own adventure? Is it the, I don't have time, but I want exposure, so I'm going to pick Yield Street product? How do you think about all of that from an investor experience perspective and also user engagement perspective?
The oldest part of our business is the DIY direct-to-consumer business, right? That's how we started, and we have 500,000 users on our platform. We've invested over $5.5 billion. Since inception. Our biggest source of inflows is going to come from the DIY customer. The recommendations, which is Guide Me, has some very, very interesting tailwinds. It's a much more recent addition. It's about a year old. We get double the conversion out of the Guide Me customers. So folks who go through the recommendation process end up investing at twice the rate of folks that go through the DIY. The third, which is the fully managed, so there's two updates there. One is we had been in stealth mode working with advisors over the last year and a half. There have been a handful of advisors who use Yield Street to invest in alternatives on behalf of their clients. 2 or 3 weeks ago, we announced a big partnership with Luma. Luma is one of the foremost distributors of structured products to advisors, and they also distribute structured note product through Yield Street. Yield Street's third most popular product is structured notes. Luma had been getting a tremendous amount of inbound from its advisor group that said, hey, we need more alternative product to distribute to our client base. Can you help us? And Luma had come to Yield Street and saying, hey, we have this longstanding partnership. You guys have the most diversified and the most curated offerings. Can you distribute your products through Luma to our customer base? So we are now distributing fully managed products as well as individual products to thousands of RIAs. I think right now, to answer your question, DIY is number one, recommendations or Guide Me is number two, and Do It For Me is number three. I think in 5 years from now, it'll probably be the reverse. Probably going to be fully managed as one.
That's a really interesting take, because where that makes my mind go is I actually don't know if your competitor is necessarily just the competitor who you mentioned that's 25% size and scale to you. I actually wonder, as these large alternative asset managers, these multi-strat platforms, many publicly traded, start to come and work more with the wealth channel, do you view the Apollos, Blackstones, Blue Owls, Ares as competitors, or are they working with a different customer type who wouldn't engage with a Yield Street?
I think about it a little bit differently. I think what the large asset managers are doing, in my opinion, is they're capturing as much assets as quickly as they can in the first wave. I don't think it's the right long-term solution, and I'll explain why. As an individual, are you going to put all your alts exposure in Apollo or Blackstone or Carlyle, or are you going to want diversification?
Diversification.
So now you got to research which platforms, how much you want to allocate, which products, and then how much to each one, and now you got to sign up to all of them. I think what they're missing, what we invested the last 10 years studying obsessively and learning, is the individual user journey and the customer experience. What they have spent the last 10 years learning is distributing to advisors. What advisors are now faced with doing is that last mile marketing to their customer to build that portfolio. What Yield Street offers you, we're not in competition with Apollo or KKR or Blackstone. We want to offer their products on our platform. So you should all bring your products to Yield Street, and we should be able to help package and distribute those either individually through the GuideMe or in a managed portfolio. In a managed portfolio at Yield Street, you might have a Carlyle fund, a Stepstone fund, an Apollo fund, and 10 bespoke products. That, I think, is the future. You got to lead with the investor. Always keep the customer right in front of you. What's best for the customer, not best for the asset manager?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. I do think that the space is maturing to the point where a lot of these firms want to be the one-stop shops. I think advisor, intermediary as the decision maker relative to the individual does create differences and nuances. From my perspective, I think the advisors are actually going to choose the one-stop shop because and do a lot of different things with them. It doesn't mean they couldn't do that with you. I think that their workflows and their day-to-day mean that they have so many other things to do that they are going to pick a product or platform. It's interesting to think about the individual in that context too, and how much of their wallet share will want to be done self-directed versus through either intermediaries or ways in which you invest, like you say. From that perspective, how do you think about the fully managed product as something that grows at Yield Street? What do you do to make that user experience better? What do you do to maybe not compete with some of these other players, but effectively you're creating your own fund product in a sense like others could as well? How do you think about that experience as that part of the business, like you say, may continue to grow?
Over the last 12 to 14 months, we have been in stealth mode building a robo product for private and public alts. It doesn't exist anywhere in the market. Nobody's building it. It is going to be transformational. We've done it with one of the largest, I'll call it players in the market, more than $1 trillion of asset under advisement. And ultimately, it's not about Yield Street proprietary product. There are some amazing asset managers in the world where we want to be the number one distribution platform. We don't want to be Blackstone with a website. What we're focused on is creating a robo product that's going to bring in the Apollos, the KKRs, the Carlyles, the Blackstones, the BlackRocks, and all of that liquid and private market product into a managed portfolio solution. It is going to be transformative. You can buy it here directly. You could buy it through your advisor. I think ultimately what's going to happen is all these asset managers are going to realize that Yield Street has spent a decade figuring out that customer journey and how to build that perfect product and experience for their customer. They're going to be better off distributing that same product through us. I think the real sort of competitor, if you will, is a much, much bigger beast, and we're only sort of a pimple to them. Is it the Schwabs of the world? Is it the Fidelities of the world? Meaning, you look at those types of platforms, neither of them have a particular edge or value proposition over the other. They have their stocks exposure, they have their bond exposure, they sell ETFs, they have a couple of other things. But here you have this massive tailwind saying 30 to even 50% of your portfolio should be private markets or alternatives, and they don't have the capabilities to distribute that. How are they going to create a seamless experience for their customers to properly round out their portfolio? And I think over time, what you might see is a partnership with Yield Street being the leader in private market investing.
There's a lot to unpack there. Some really interesting points about how you think about distribution. In your mind, what does it take to be the best distributor of product, Yield Street or otherwise, in this space?
It's going to take a seamless experience for your customer and providing them with the best possible product. It always starts and ends with the customer.
From that perspective, from the years that you've been doing this, and obviously you have the advisor component as well, but you started with the individual investor. You understand the individual investor from years of working with them. What do you think you know about the individual investor and what they want in this space that others may not?
Everything.
What do you mean by that?
We're the only ones that focused on them. We know what makes them tick. We know how they think. We know what they're interested in buying. We have a data science team. We look at their sentiment at a real-time basis. We see the velocity of sales. We understand how many clicks are comfortable, what's cumbersome. We know how they want an investment position to frame. Half the market is still busy showing you a 200-page PPM and asking you to go over it. Like, What world is that going to happen in? You're going to chop up this video into 100 clicks and hope that people watch 60-second clips, but someone else is still giving you a 200-page PBM. They're missing the customer experience. What I believe is that we're not an investment platform. We're a consumer business. We happen to be selling investments. The rest of the market's not there. I don't go to the market and tell people, oh, Michael and his team of people are the smartest investors. We have incredible talent. We have great investors and we have a great investment team. What we're really good at is understanding who our customer is and what the experience they want. So while everybody has been focused in the market on trying to educate and sell to advisors, we're not only going to do that, but we're then going to help the advisor go that last mile. Because it's new for them too to explain to their customer, how is private markets going to help your portfolio? What should it look like? Or their client is seeing private markets advertisements or conversation or articles in the Wall Street Journal. They call their advisor. They say, Sally, how come I don't have any private markets in my portfolio? So Sally says, oh, okay, I'm going to work on it for you and come back to you. Now, when she comes back to you, what is she telling you? What's that last mile? What is the portfolio she's going to show you? How is it diversified? What's the theme? Oh, you know how I always educated you on 60-40? There should be a balance between growth and income. I'm going to do the same thing for you in private markets. How? I'm going to show you private credit and private equity. And here are some examples. Or did you see that Otero bought a big stake in Alpine, the Formula One team? I know you love Formula One. You're seeing the Netflix show. It's growing. The revenues are growing. Guess what? We could have a stake in that. Wow, that's so interesting. So there's still a consumer at the other end of the portfolio. Understanding that consumer journey and meeting them where they are.
On that point, what have you found resonates most with the consumer? Is it the specific deal? Is it the strategy? Is it the fact that the characteristics of the product yield? Is it something else that you find tends to be what the investor cares about most? Or is it trust? They trust the diligence process, the sourcing, and maybe it's more than one of those things, but I'm just trying to get an understanding of what the investor's behavior is and what they really are interested in when coming to a platform like Yield Street and why they want to work with you.
There are different customer segmentations and different things work for different people. Some people get comfortable by knowing that other smart investors are in a product. Some people get comfortable by doing the work and understanding the material or having a webinar. Having customer segmentation and knowing your customer and their journey is super important. You and I could have a very different experience on Yield Street because our system will know that we react to different things and it will show us different things. The one common denominator, though, simplicity. That is the one common denominator. People too often don't give the investor or the customer credit for their intuition. They can smell nonsense a mile away. They want simplicity, they want clarity, and that's how they build trust. If you try to sort of overstuff them with financial jargon or verbiage, they either don't trust it or they're gone. But if you could break something down and explain to them very simply, for example, there's currently an investment on our platform. I don't know when this will air, so it'll probably be gone by then. But I think it's called Power Sports. Power Sports is a company that we did a deal with called Octane Lending. I think it's just under a $300 million deal. JP Morgan's the senior. And they're in the business of providing consumer loans for the tens of thousands range. If you buy an ATV or a jet ski or a passion asset, they have unbelievable performance. Now, if you went into securitization and you read the docs, good luck in trying to figure out what they do. If you ask me, it's very simple. A guy walks into a store, he's been waiting to get a jet ski for the last 5 years. He finally gets it, he puts down $5,000, he borrows $10,000. He's going to make that payment no matter what. It's his passion asset, it's just $300 a month. You now have a portfolio of 12,500 of those loans. It's highly diversified. It performs super well. You'll get paid 13% monthly. They're like, oh, wow, that's super interesting. I get it. The rest of the world doesn't present it that way. Now, obviously, there's a lot more there, and you go into the details and you discuss it. But simplicity is key.
You're bringing up a really interesting point about simplicity. I want to talk about that concept, both pre-investment, sourcing, and diligence. And then post-investment, I think a number of the investments you have, you make it easy for people to invest, see their statements, see the updates. Like you say, even on the website, I thought very easy to see the different strategies or asset classes, what the returns have been, what the payment periods and cycles have looked like for each of those, which I think is very helpful and digestible. If we think about pre-investment, how do you go about sourcing and diligencing these opportunities? Is it sourcing them directly? Are you sourcing them through funds? Are you partnering with funds? How do you do that both to A, source high quality investment opportunities, and B, related to that and related to your earlier point about making sure the end customer is happy. How do you think about getting them to trust you?
Trust is earned. It's not bought. You don't just get someone to trust you. You earn people's trust over years. You earn people's trust through performance in the good and the tough times. You earn people's trust by fighting through challenges, by providing consistency. You earn people's trust by under-promising and over-delivering. And you earn people's trust when you're building a business by taking their feedback and improving upon it and being authentic and being genuine. There's no silver bullet to earning trust. It took us a long time and we fight for it every day. And I don't lose sight of the idea that you could spend a lifetime earning trust and a minute losing it. There's no hack. There's no shortcut. The key is, again, just be obsessed with the customer. Think of the user journey. When I build a product that you on the other end enjoy and feel like it was built for you, you will trust me more because you will have a subconscious message in your head that says, he gets what I want. This is it. This is what I've been looking for. And when you feel that we have a shared knowledge of what is good for you and we're building it, you feel comfortable that, hey, they know what my needs are and they're meeting them. A big part of getting trust from your customers is actually obsessing about what that client experience needs to look like and the user journey needs to look like. Moving to the asset curation. One, we're not in the business of selling you a deal. We're in the business of helping people build diversified portfolios. The differentiator is we don't go out looking in the market for the next best deal. That's not how we operate. We're looking for homogeneous, scalable supply. We have a theme. It's single family rentals. It's multifamily. It's real estate debt. We want to go out and then find the best operators, best managers, or best partners we can that could scale dramatically with us. Because if we could do X this year, I want to do 5X or 10X next year. I can't look for 10 new partners every time. So I'd rather find the KKR or the Ares or the Octane or the Harbor Group in real estate or 100 other partners of ours that we could do 10 million the first time, 50 million the next time, 500 million in 2 years from now. They are big shops. They're managing billions. They have long track records or top decile performance. What I'm able to do is go into management and many times like C-suite CEOs of some of these biggest asset managers, my pitch is very simple. I represent 500,000 people. I represent family offices, institutions, endowments, and RIAs. We are looking to find best-in-class opportunities, and we're able to help you distribute into a whole new market. Let's help more people get access to private market investing. Let's help more people get access to some of the best quality investments and really drive change for the people that will have a healthier portfolio and help your organization scale. It's a very powerful message when you walk and say, hey, I got 500,000 people that I'm here to represent. That's how we get access to some of the best opportunities and often at even more compelling prices than you can get anywhere else.
How much does partnering with brand names, like you mentioned, the Apollo, the KKR, et cetera, how much does that help when engendering trust with the investors that you have on the YieldTree platform?
Okay, we're going to have fun with this. How much do you think it helps? Scale of 1 to 10.
I think probably helps a lot. I think probably 8 or 9. 0.
But let me tell you why. So I thought 8 or 9. That's why when we first got into the third-party fund business, the idea was, hey, you could be a reasonably wealthy person. And what's a reasonably wealthy person in a high net worth? You pick a number.
Depends on how you're cutting the wealth channel. I think on a more self-directed basis versus advisor-led is kind of like 20 million plus. They're going to a large advisor and expecting to get sophisticated private equity or private markets offerings. I'd say sub 20, you may get more self-directed mindsets of people still very incredibly wealthy and in the QP category, 5 million net worth of investable assets, net worth and above. But I would delineate between those two categories.
Let's go in the middle. Let's get 10 million or even you could double it for the math at 20. If you have 10 million, just to keep numbers simple and you want 30% of your portfolio to be privates and alts, that's $3 million. You want a diversified portfolio at 3 million. What do you want each position to be? Max 5 to 10%, 150 to 300K. You don't have a lot of access. At 20 million bucks, still don't have a lot of access. That's 300 to 600K. Some of the best opportunities, the best funds, the best co-invests, not for you. What YieldStreet recognized was if we could leverage our technology capabilities and our distribution, our audience, I could go to a KKR or whoever and say, hey, we'll do a $25 or a $50 million allocation. And then behind the scenes on our side, we'll fractionalize that into a Yield Street fund. Now I could take you in for $50,000. So you could have very wealthy people that are being advised. And the advisor's issue is, I can't allocate $250,000, $300,000, $500,000 clips for my $10 million client. And by the way, my $5 million client, who let's say is a very successful person, how many people are $5 million net worth in America? You're still in the top 10%. Where are they going? We thought that this would be an incredible opportunity, and we are going to use the brands of some of these biggest players, and ooh, it's going to grow. I think what, going back to the question that you had about the Apollos and those asset managers, what they don't realize is outside of Park 5th, 6th Avenue, Madison, like no one knows who they are. If you leave your studio today and you go ask the first 20 people, do you know who Apollo is? I'll give you $100 if more than five people say we know who they are. There's no chance. So we thought that would happen. One of the investors and advisors at Yield Street is Mark Lassery. And Avenue Capital was one of the first funds that we did business with. Mark has been a personal mentor, and I am very thankful for him and his friendship. And I thought the whole world would know who Mark Lassery is. Avenue Capital, $90 billion invested over time, co-owner of the Milwaukee Bucks, big profile. They didn't know him. So that's the other side. We are building brands for our partners. We have a huge audience. We're introducing these brands. As they perform, we bring on more products of theirs. More products, more success, beget more distribution. And more retail investors are now learning about these brands. The way Blackstone and BREIT were so successful is by spending billions of dollars marketing to advisors and educating the market. But you go to Iowa, you go to Utah, no one knows who these people are.
And not every firm can do that either. I think you're bringing up an interesting point, particularly for firms who are not small, tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars, but maybe have not put the resources into marketing directly to the wealth channel, or only now are they just starting. But that's really interesting perspective to say, hey, maybe we can help bring you, asset manager, to this cohort of people and bring your brand. Is that something you're seeing happen increasingly more with these large alternative asset managers saying, hey, you have built this audience of individual investors who want to do alts clearly and are engaging with you directly to do that, so they want to come and be on your platform?
Not enough. I think they're still very proud, and I think the management team and the C-suite still believe that they have a big brand. The ones that have worked with us realized very quickly that we were right, meaning how to frame a particular opportunity or the firm, and it was so stuffy. You would cringe when you would read it. It was not a consumer product, and they started to read it, or they would see the webinar we recorded. For example, Bonaccord Capital Partners, a great fund, GP stakes business. AJ's a rock star. We know him for a while. I'll never forget it. He recorded his first webinar and he texts me later and he goes, no go, doing it again. I call him, I say, what happened? He goes, that sucked. I said, what do you mean? He goes, I was like talking to a pension fund. It was so stuffy. We do the most exciting things. We have incredible investments. The opportunity is amazing. Our performance is great. We're invested in so many things. Why am I not talking about it passionately? Like a normal conversation. We're so conditioned to do this. And he came in, he redid it. They ended up raising, I don't remember exactly, maybe 30, 35 million. We have gone back into market with them and they've done phenomenally well. Our investors love the opportunity to get access to it, or we're an aviation leasing strategy. You know how exciting that is? Most people don't know that 50% of the global commercial fleet is actually owned by private equity firms. So people invested in the fund. We gave them the tail numbers of the planes that are in the fund. So now they get to not only invest in something that's done high teens returns, but they enjoy it. Michael, they call us up and they say, hey, I flew to Denver. The craziest thing happened. I was on the United plane that we own. You could talk like that and you can make it exciting and enjoyable. They have no idea how to do that.
You're hitting on a theme that I think is becoming increasingly important in private markets, which is humanizing it and making it feel accessible and real, not only from an investment perspective, like the access you're providing and others are providing, but also just from a storytelling perspective. How do you think firms should go about building and telling the narrative, just like you said, but how do you continue to do that as a platform?
Let's talk about Robinhood. You open the Robinhood app, there's confetti flying everywhere. The thing is like vibrating like a V phone did in 2000. You look at your phone and you got a dividend and you're like, oh, this is amazing. This is great. I got paid, whatever. They did nothing. Robinhood didn't give you the dividend. It was the same exact stock you could have bought anywhere. They have no influence in the performance. They didn't do anything. You didn't get the dividend because of them. But the experience they created out of it was completely different than anyone else was ever doing. I'm not saying that we should gamify what we do for our audience. Our audience is elevated, it's bespoke, it's wealthy, but humanizing it is everything. I don't think that these firms should be spending an enormous amount of time communicating in these ways and building the whole infrastructure. Okay. Because I think if you think a few years ahead, no single firm should be more than one portion of the private portfolio. So you're investing all these dollars to get, what, 10%, 5% of a person's total wallet share? I rather say, hey, invest with us or invest with a distribution platform who's going to help craft the story with you, build the brand for you, take those billions of dollars, give me 10% of it and say, okay, allocate $50 million over the next 5 years to my brand and my spend, we'll do a much better job. Meaning you got to decide who you are in life. Are you an investor or are you a distribution platform? We're a distribution platform. You're the investor. Go focus on the investments. Let us help you build the best distribution possible.
I think you're bringing up a really interesting nuance in private markets, which is one, there are different pieces of this distribution puzzle. On one hand, many of these firms have worked with platforms and leveraged technology to help create a more efficient experience post-investment. Either they built it in-house or they have that capability in-house or they're partnering with the platform. You're saying more on the distribution side. How do you think about that nuance there between those large alternative asset managers leveraging you for distribution versus leveraging you for the post-investment experience?
Can't do that. You got to be customer obsessed. The customer wants a perfect experience for the whole life cycle. You don't split it up. You come onto Yield Street from day one through top of funnel marketing. You found a theme you liked. It could have been an individual asset class or the idea of private markets. You click that. It navigates you into the right page. Through that, you learn about Yield Street. You learn about private markets. You find either the DIY, the guide me, or the managed. You click through that. You make your investment seamlessly. You want to be able to come back and you want to see reporting right in that ecosystem. You want to see your taxes seamlessly. You want to get your distribution seamlessly. You deserve to have an excellent, seamless digital experience, and we are committed to providing it for you. Our back end is maybe even better than our front end. I think a lot of tech platforms are all focused on the sale. They're focused on top of funnel, mid funnel conversion. You get to the back end, you're like, what happened here? It's 1990. That's not us. We get the reporting from those platforms. We upload it seamlessly. Everything happens right here on your app or on your phone. So I think just zooming back out for a minute, because I think we're getting very tactical and into the weeds, which is great. But zooming out, you have $70 trillion of boomer money moving to the next generation. That's one. Two, you have a growing TAM because what people used to try to say, oh, don't worry, alt should be 5% of your portfolio. I've been saying for the last 8 years, it should be 30% of your portfolio. You have Mark Rowan who came out at the end of last year saying it should be 50% of your portfolio. Then everyone's in between like 30 and 50. So it's a huge part of your portfolio that should be alts. So the TAM is growing, not just by money in motion, but by the number of people that are going to invest in alts and by the amount of their total portfolio they're going to invest in alts. For us at Yield Street, I want to build a one-stop shop solution that anyone who wants to invest in alts, irrespective of the audience type, has access to top decile investment opportunities in one of those three buckets. Internationally. For us, what I'm focused on doing right now is really just bulking up the business, continuing to extend market leadership. We acquired Cadre at the end of last year. We announced our partnership with Luma. We have this model portfolio announcement coming soon, which you'll hear more about. We have a handful of other conversations on the M&A side. We have another LOI signed, another announcement coming hopefully soon. With the Cadre acquisition, we have a lot more capabilities, which is super exciting to us. So for me, I'm super focused on what we got to do. I think that these other firms are going to continue to learn about the market. Some will decide to continue to go at it alone. Others will decide to partner with us. But there's going to be a tectonic shift in the next 24 months.
What does that tectonic shift look like to you?
Nobody owns a holistic portfolio. What are you going to do? No one does. E-Trade, Robinhood, Schwab, Interactive, Fidelity, no wealth management platform. If you want to go get one place to have stocks, bonds, and alts, and not just liquid alts, like real alts, private investment alts. Where do you do that? There is nowhere. Something major has to happen. And I think the first participants there are going to have a huge advantage over the market.
You're also hitting on something that's so important is without understanding a full portfolio, it's hard to understand where alts should fit in and what types of strategies should be part of an investor's allocation at a specific period in time?
I think people maybe overcomplicate it.
So what are the next 12 to 24 months look like in your mind? What are you focused on?
I'm focused on three things. One is growth. I want to continue to build the business. I want to continue to extend market leadership. Yield Street has capabilities that no one else has. In our Cadre acquisition, we were able to get nearly 70% efficiency. Our technology is able to onboard their assets and onboard their customers, give them a better experience. What we really want to continue to invest in Cadre is going to be the investment team and their prowess, their capability to sort of generate revenue and generate asset growth. And on the IR team, who's focused on the family office endowments and international relationships, which are all new channels for us. And then all of the sort of infrastructure expense, which is technology, data, product, marketing, finance, legal, we really are able to absorb into Yield Street. No one else could do that. There is not another company that could have bought them and have the same sort of synergies and growth capabilities as we do, because no one else has built that distribution infrastructure we spoke about. We continue to speak to a lot of other market participants. I think you'll see us doing some more transactions selectively. The reason it's exciting for us is, one, we're growing our revenue, which is exactly where I want to be. I want to be able to have an exciting outcome for Yield Street, take Yield Street public when the markets open up, hopefully in and around 26. I think we have to get to a scaled revenue, a scaled EBITDA to do that. So continuing to see growth organically and inorganically is attractive. Two, we're getting these great users. Cadre had nearly $1.2 billion in AUM, half is split by high net worth, half is split by institutions and endowments. We have thousands of more customers that have only ever been shown real estate. So cross-selling those products is really exciting. That's something we've become absolute experts in. People come to Yield Street with the view that they clicked on that ad for that asset and they were here for real estate or here for something else. Give us a few months and all of a sudden they're in five different asset classes and they have a diversified portfolio. So growing deeper relationships and going deeper in wallet share is exciting. Then we have the OpEx synergies that we spoke about, and then differentiated distribution and technology. We have been very excited about launching a true secondary market. Cadre is a broker-dealer and has an ATS. We were a registered investment advisor. Now, through the acquisition, we are regulated both by the SEC and by FINRA. Looking ahead, being able to launch a secondary market is going to be incredibly exciting. If private markets can see a little bit more liquidity, it doesn't have to be full-blown liquidity. If you can see a little bit more liquidity, I think you're going to see massive accelerated growth. So for us, growth is number one.
One question on liquidity, because it's an important topic to cover. Does liquidity come more in the form of product structuring or a secondaries market?
I'm thinking first in terms of secondaries.
And that you'll have that in-house because you have the ATS.
The ATS is what allows you to functionally have one. The problem in the market is you have companies like Forge and NASDAQ private markets. They're down, what, roughly 80% volume? They only have secondaries and these illiquid LP interests maybe, or secondaries and startups. Nobody has diversity of product and nobody has a big enough audience, which is essentially no one has the right supply-demand mix. Yield Street does. We've done over 500 investments across all these asset classes. We probably have 300 or 350 open at any time. Then we have on the other side tens of thousands of users. So if you want to be able to buy credit or real estate or private equity or art or et cetera, we're the only place you could find all that. I think we really have an opportunity to build a market, a dual-sided market, that others don't have the diversity of product and the scale user base to be able to do that. So that'll be really exciting. And then I think on number two, it's really demonstrate profitability as we scale. People in this market want to see strong unit economics and real leverage in the business. We've made the investments over the last 8 years. We're now truly a platform. We're getting a tremendous amount of leverage, as was demonstrated by the Cadre piece. So really just focused on delivering on that. Then the third piece is really demonstrating the power of the institutional grade technology. If someone came to us and said, hey, we want to partner with you. We want to own the holistic portfolio. We have stocks and bond capabilities. We don't have private. We don't have all capabilities. We want to do a test. Here's a million or 5 million of our top clients. We need to be able to demonstrate that our technology can seamlessly provide an incredible service and a delightful experience to those customers. Demonstrating that we do, in fact, have market-leading technology and it's differentiated technology and it would take you years to build. Those are the three things I'm focused on. I think I do those three things, continue to build an amazing business, build real enterprise value, and really continue to extend our leadership in the market.
Other than creating a holistic portfolio for investors and alts, what do you think, as you think about the market structure of private markets from pre to post trade or investment, do you think is still missing that needs to be built?
I think a lot of it is in flight. I do think a fully managed robo is important. You have the Betterments and the Wealthfronts Republic, and those have become very popular solutions in a sort of a pre-robo is this idea of ETFs and mutual fund where you have these diversified fund exposures. You need that to exist in privates to be able to get massive adoption. If you look at when public equities really became as big as they are, as you think of the Vanguard days, or you think of when mutual funds really started to open up, that really created a tremendous rush of capital. People not only want to have some level of advice or guidance or trust, but they also want to have diversification. So I do think that the private markets need to see an expansion of product type and investment packaging to expand at the scale that we're envisioning and that we're talking about. That's one. I do think liquidity is important. You think about your equities portfolio, securities baseline or margin or whatnot are just very common in the very smart ways of how to leverage and multiply your earning capability. You don't really have that in the private market. Even if you're super wealthy, you could have $20 million across 10 great managers. I don't think you can borrow $5 million against that. Why not? You should. I think having the secondary market is ultimately going to create a lot of lending opportunity. So in stocks, that worst case, I'll just sell it at whatever the price is in the market. As a margin lender, I'll never lose money. In the privates, because of the illiquid nature, it's much harder to create lending solutions. But if you have a liquidity solution, you'll have lending solutions. That'll be a huge business. I think that's required. There's a host of other things we're working on that I don't want to talk about just yet. I think we've done a good job at surprising the market and coming to market with things that people are like, wow, that's really smart and interesting and exciting. So I want to hold a little back. The other side is, how do you leverage tax advantage money for private market investing? So IRA, which is a huge, huge up.
Where does that come into play?
The short answer is, if you could defer taxes, you're compounding growth at somewhere between 20 and 40% or 50%, depending on where you live. It's an enormous opportunity. Most people haven't leveraged their IRAs as well as they should. Obviously, the most famous story is Peter Thiel putting a tremendous amount of equity in that. What we have done is we've continued to make inroads into the self-directed IRA market. In 2023, was a huge year for us from that perspective. We entered into a joint venture with Equity Trust. Equity Trust is the largest self-directed IRA platform in America, 50 billion AUC, 250,000, 300,000 accounts. We built a fully integrated SSO solution. So you can go onto your Equity Trust account. I think they call it My Equity. And ultimately, through that experience, it'll show you Yield Street eligible IRA offerings. And then boom, just port your data over and make an investment straight in. We think there's huge growth and a huge opportunity there. But again, we're thinking about the customer and how to help you have the best experience and the best portfolio. Then we're going out to the other side of the market and bringing all the right product in. I think last week we offered StepStone with an IRA wrapper, one of the top performing sort of core venture funds out there, $40 billion asset manager. And returns in the mid to high teens consistently for a very long time. And all of a sudden now it's available in your IRA. That's incredible. And so we're really trying to just think about, how do we help people build wealth, build financial independence, get alpha, have a better portfolio, and invest like billionaires when you're not. And it's working.
That's great to hear. I think to hear that that's where this, both the platform and the space are maturing is obviously really exciting for alt. I want to end by asking a question I always ask every guest, which is, what is your favorite or most interesting alternative investment?
Litigation finance.
Why?
It's, for me, the definition of perceived risk and actual risk are not the same. It's totally uncorrelated to the market. There's typically very little collectability risk because there's insurance companies most likely on the other side of that obligation in a diversified fashion. It's quite low risk if done in a large diversified portfolio. It's bespoke, and I've done super well in the space, so I really enjoy it.
Talk a little bit more about perceived and actual risk and how you approach that framework, because I think that it's a fascinating way of looking at all sorts of investments, and I think people might find that interesting.
I'll use a fun example because it's the most simple to explain. When the NBA had a lockout, you recall back, it's probably over 10 years now, there was a fight over the media rights between the players and the owners. Right, and the players always want more, the owners always want to give less. So the players go on strike, and it's really a waiting game. The owners are never going to let it go too far, because if they miss too much of a season, they lose the media right package for the whole season. The question is, who can hold out longer? Most people think that all players are like LeBron or Jordan or Kobe, and they have unlimited money. It's not the case. Look at the roster. Most players are on the lower end of that roster. They're still making a lot of money, but there's a couple of things. One, the younger players are often coming from underserved communities, and when they make it, they got to spend quite a bit They're there for their families. They're buying homes. They're buying cars. It's their first major check. They go from a high school student or a college student to getting $1 million or $2 or $3 million. And there's taxes and there's pensions. A lot of money gets pulled out really quickly. And the middle players, it's not that easy. In today's world, they feel often they have to keep up a persona. They're on social media, they're buying things, et cetera. And I think 95% of professional athletes go broke within 5 years out of the league. They're often running out of capital a lot faster than the owners are. So we came up with an idea, which was, let's provide loans to players secured by their guaranteed contracts. Now, the reason the first half of the explanation is important is because most players at that level don't have good credit. They can't actually go to a bank and get $1 million loan, which is a crazy thing for most people to process. The way I looked at it was, I have a contract that's backed by a team or the NBA. So the credit's really not the guy with the 600 score. It's really the team. Now, the contract's guaranteed, and it has, I think, 5 loopholes: death, disgrace, disability, walk-off risk, or fraud. Those were my 5 risks. Lloyd's had a policy that covered death, disgrace, and disability. If any of those 3 happened, I was good. Walk-off risk, got to get in front of the player, got to get in front of the family and make sure the player has high integrity. You just got to show up. And fraud was easy. We weren't closing deals with agents. We were closing deals directly with players. So if I can lend players against the contract and have an assignment of the cash flow in the contract into a bank account of the fund and then distribute after we get repaid to the player, then my risk is basically the team's credit risk. And we know that at some point, they're going to work it out. So I have a guaranteed contract with a probably investment grade or close to investment grade like credit, and I'm getting paid high teens for that risk. That's a great detailed example, but fun example of perceived risk versus actual. The average investor would come in and say, okay, let me run your credit. You have 600 credit score. You have little cash. No way. I'm not giving you $1 million. I didn't look at that. That didn't matter to me. I looked at, where's my money coming from? Coming from the team, it's coming from the NBA. That's my credit risk. That's perceived risk, 600 credit score, versus actual risk, really, really strong collateral package. We didn't have a single default. We got paid like clockwork. It was pretty awesome. The players ended up being able to negotiate a much higher contract because they were able to have longer staying power. And it was fun.
It's also an interesting perspective to think about. If leagues provided guaranteed contracts, not every league does. There's obviously reasons why, but think of what you could do for the financial security and upside of players.
That's a conversation I'm super passionate about. I invested a lot of time in trying to be a solution. It didn't work. There's a lot of gatekeepers. I've ultimately chosen to let that market be.
Maybe eventually you can get into that as more and more sports get there as well. Well, this was fantastic conversation. Really enjoyed it. Covered a lot of ground. Congrats on the business that you've built and are continuing to build at Yield Street. So, Michael, thanks for coming on the Alco's Mainstream Podcast. Pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun, and I loved how we kept it macro and got really in the weeds at the same time. It was a great conversation. Thank you very much.
Likewise. Well, appreciate it, and thanks to you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Alco's Mainstream. I hope you enjoyed it. You can read more about alts at my Substack, altgoesmainstream.substack.com. Thanks a lot, and have a great day. We're going